It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions. You're listening to A New Dimensions Archive Edition, recorded in 2014.
If we learn how to reframe the pieces of our past in our life stories so that suffering becomes meaningful, we can radically boost our chances of healing, empowerment, growth, and transformation. Today we'll be exploring how focused journaling and short writing exercises can be powerful tools to achieve this aim with our guest, Catherine Ann Jones. Catherine Ann Jones is an award-winning playwright and screenwriter and a Fulbright scholar to India studying shamanism. She holds a graduate degree and teaches depth psychology and archetypal mythology. As a screenwriter, Jones has contributed to such television series as Touched by an Angel and wrote the teleplay The Christmas Wife. She teaches writing workshops and is the author of Heal Yourself Through Writing and The Way of Story, The Craft and Soul of Writing. Join us for the next hour as we explore how we can engage in deep inner work through writing with our guest, Catherine Ann Jones. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Catherine, welcome.
Happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you. I mean, you've just told me that you have just arrived from Kuwait. That was a long, long trip.
It was 20 hours in the air.
20 hours in the air.
11 hours time difference.
Wow. So you've been teaching writing in Kuwait and really teaching all over the world.
Yes. It's very interesting because, as Muriel Rukeyser said, the wonderful poet from New York, the world is made up of stories, not atoms. And there's stories all over the world.
Mentioning that, I know that in your book, The Way of Story, you have a prologue piece that is so beautiful. I would love for you to share that piece with our listeners.
I'd be happy to. I'll ask the listeners if they would to close their eyes when they hear.
Unless they're driving.
Unless they're driving, then please don't. And instead of just hearing the words, try and feel the words. In the beginning was story. The caveman rushed back to his tribe and excitedly acted out his encounter with some Paleolithic beast. This was his story. And forever after, he would be remembered by this story. Stories have a sacred dimension, not because of gods, but because a man or woman's sense of self and her world is created through them. These stories orient the life of a people through time, establishing the reality of their world. Thus, meaning and purpose are given to people's lives. Without story, we do not exist. The way of story is how we discover who we are.
Beautifully said. So let's talk about story. And you've suggested that to know our own story is how we're able to change it.
Yes, it is a revisioning. One of the key themes of the new book, Heal Yourself with Writing, is that our lives may be determined less by past events than by the way we remember them. So memory is very subjective and changeable. I mean, I learned this raising my son. I'd remember something when he was little that we were both present for, And I would say it, and my son would say, no, Mother, that's not what happened at all. It was this, this, and this. So we know from experience, no two people remember the same thing the same way. So perhaps the way, for especially remembering trauma or some traumatic experience, the way we remember is probably as or more important than what actually happened. Because I find for the healing of grief and trauma, what has to happen is a shift in perspective. So that's sort of a cornerstone of my work with this.
So workshop. In other words, we can't change the event itself, but we can change our perspective of
yes.
it. I know
exactly.
that there's a phrase that you use in the book that I loved. It was called, what you remember remembers you.
Yeah.
What you remember remembers you. What do you mean by that?
Well, one example is there was diverting a little bit, but it's a way to answer what you asked. The New York Times recently did an article that 30 years ago, talking therapy was what everyone did. You went and did a talking therapy with a psychiatrist or psychotherapist. Today, it's writing workshops. One of the challenges of just talking therapy, say you're talking about a trauma or traumatic event, it's possible to re-traumatize the body by telling your story over and over again. Because the body doesn't know the difference between the real trauma and a simulated trauma, hence talking about it. So what is needed and what I try and do in the workshop and with the exercises in the book is distance the perceiver from the event. And in this way, you can shift perspectives, and that creates a gap between what happened and what you remember or perceive. And in that gap is where the healing takes place.
So what would somebody do to distance themselves? What is your suggestion?
I'll give an example. For instance, one of the many exercises I do for healing trauma, I have them first write down in broad strokes what the traumatic event was, very simply. And then I have several versions in this exercise where they write about the event from different points of view. For instance, write about it from a point of view of a hero or heroine and what you learn from this. And it ends up, the last part of that exercise is write about the event from the point of view of the perpetrator. For instance, I've had rape victims in the workshops often, so write about it from the point of view of the rapist. It's very hard, but in doing that, you're shifting your perspective to a more objective or different. If you first remember a trauma, inevitably you write about it from a victim point of view. And by telling that story again and again, I was raped at the whatever it is, you kind of put in cement your victim mentality. But if you can shift the perspective away from victimhood to hero or heroine or even the perpetrator, it creates a distance. And it's in that distance or gap where the healing takes place.
So if there's some habit in our life that we want to change, I would think that this would also be a
exactly.
good technique to it's yeah. hard to change it from the inside out. Let's, for example, I had this idea for myself.
Yeah.
My desk continues to be piled. I mean, I get it kind of cleaned off, but then it just seems like overnight it just piles up again. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, maybe I could do, when I read your book and looked at all the wonderful exercises, I thought maybe I could write about my desk from the viewpoint of the desk.
Yes, very like, good. Very
to use that as my focal point and write it toward myself rather than from inside myself.
Exactly, right on. Another of the exercises is what I call the body dialogues, where you actually hold a dialogue with the part of your body that's giving you some trouble. With me, it's the neck. I have perennial because of old accidents or whatever. Someone else, it could be stomach or whatever. So you speak to that body part and you listen to what it wants to tell you. And, you know, my neck might tell me, you know, I've tried to tell you, but you won't listen. You need to slow down. Stop jumping all over the world on these long trips to do it and so on, and give us time to rest and so on. And then the last part is you answer your body's voice and saying, I hear you this time, so I am going to try and take better care of you or whatever. I know it sounds a little simplistic, but it increases awareness that our body does speak to us. And at first it whispers. And if we don't listen, it's going to shout.
Right. You know? Yes, so. I think we've all experienced that.
Yeah.
So this is a way of
starting, shifting perspective.
And starting to hear your inner voice.
Your inner voice and also your somatic voice.
Your somatic, the body. Your body voice.
A lot of the book is about cultivating the intuitive inner voice. And in both of my books, they're both partial memoirs, I use anecdotes from my own life and journey to illustrate principles I'm teaching. And there's a personal example that's rather dramatic of cultivating the intuitive voice. When I was in my early 20s, I was an actor in New York City. That was my first career in the theater. And I was going to visit a woman friend of mine who had just come from Europe acting in a film. She lived on Central Park South. So I walked into her flat. And the first moment I walked in, I felt uneasy. There was no logical reason why I should feel uneasy. So I pushed it away with my logical left brain. I said, that's silly. I've just arrived. This is an old friend and so on. She sat me down in a chair near the window overlooking Central Park. Soon as I sat in that chair, a very clear inner voice said, you're in danger. Leave. Leave now. Again, I tried to push it away, but it became so persistent. Within 5 minutes, I said, I'm sorry, Patricia, I'm not feeling well, I have to go, and I left. About 15 minutes later, I walked into my own apartment, and the phone was ringing. Pick up the phone, it's Patricia. She says, Catherine, you'll never believe what happened just a few minutes after you left. I said, what? You know that chair you were sitting in by the window? I said, yes. Well, you know, in New York, the old buildings have these huge air conditioning units that are as big as a dining table, you know, huge. It was windy that day, and one had fallen off the building, crashed into that window onto that chair where I was sitting. I would have been killed.
Wow.
So the moral is, listen to that inner voice. It could save your life.
I'm here with Catherine Ann Jones. She's the author of Heal Yourself with Writing. My name is Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Catherine, I'd love to know, what is the difference between automatic writing and the kind of focused journaling that you talk about?
Good question. Automatic writing is a little more general, just write whatever you feel like and so on. Focused journaling is more like a laser beam to your psyche. So it's very specific. It asks very specific things, like in the first chapter, what story are you living? We ask, are you living your own story or the story of your parent? You know, Carl Jung, the psychologist, said, there's no greater influence on a child than the unlived life of the parent. So often we're not living our own dream or story, but we're living a parent's projection or so on.
So what are some of your suggestions for us to disentangle that story from our authentic story from that which we're living out of our parents or other people?
Good question. One of all of the exercises in the book are really trying to make you more aware of your authentic self. So we examine desire. What is it we desire? There's one exercise that people seem to enjoy where I ask them at age 12, I wanted to be, and you fill in the blank, at age 22, and you add 10 years and go on up. And you notice that what you wanted to be or what you desired changed over the decades. So that's one awareness technique, to see the history of what you wanted to be or do. And then the follow-up exercise is, what about you has stayed the same? What has been the constant in your life in terms of your desire, what you want it to be? So there's a lot of transient desires or dreams, but there's often a constant, and that constant will point you toward what you really should be doing now.
I would imagine, I'm just hearing that, like what stayed the same, it may seem like an easy question, but that might not be an easy question for us to view our own lives with a kind of broadness that we need to know ourselves. How would you suggest that we know what stayed the same?
In my case, I think even though I had different careers, two things stayed the same. There was always a spiritual quest. I was always a seeker. And that preceded, career moves or marriage or whatever, is that I wanted to know. I wanted to know that it's greater than I am. And the other thing that stayed the same was self-expression through the arts, creative self-expression. That was always, even though it was acting for one decade and playwriting for another and then screenwriting and then book writing, there was always that push to self-express through creativity.
You had some surprises that came into your life to help guide you in some of those. And I remember one of your stories, I think you were at a wedding and needed to change something, and you met a surprising person. Can you say something about that?
Well, I had been an actor for 8, 9, 10 years or so, and I had just acted in a great performance. I played the lead in a play that PBS aired nationally. And yet something stopped in me, and I knew it was time to stop acting. Well, logically, it didn't make sense because it was a very big moment in my my career. But I followed that inner voice, and I stopped cold turkey acting. 2 months went by, and I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do next. But I trusted that something would happen to show me the way. I was invited to a wedding of a friend of mine and asked to be part of the wedding, and she lived outside New York, and there were other house guests in their house, and I met this astrologer. I had never met him before, and he said, we have time. We're here 2 or 3 days. Give me your dates, and I'll look at your chart. So I said, why not? And he said, this is very interesting. I see acting, but it stops right now within the last month or so. And even though the acting was strong, your next career is going to be even stronger. And I said, what is that? He said, writing. And then it dawned on me, because I had always journaled and written, but it never occurred to me it could be a livelihood.
Right.
At that point.
So something in you resonated as soon as he said the words. It was kind of like an ally coming in to kind of...
Not only like an ally, it was an ally. Because I've noticed my whole life, if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing at each step of your life, authentically true to that deeper self, then the allies come from unexpected places to help guide you. It never fails.
And we need to develop eyes to notice them as allies.
Yeah, it could be an invisible ally. It could be a dream. It could be a book falling off a shelf, and it's just what you need to know at that time. Or it could be a stranger you happen to meet that will say something that points you. It's like clues as you go through your own adventure.
So you're saying the universe or whatever that energy source is provides these clues. We have to have eyes and ears and heart.
If you're following your deeper self, it doesn't always work when you're just doing the ego self.
Right.
If it's a vanity or an ego, I'm not saying it works on that level. But if you're as sincerely as you can following what, like I stopped acting when it made no sense, but something in me said, that's done. I had acted in about 55 plays. I had done it. But here's another interesting thing, Justine, to me at least. I had stopped acting and then I started playwriting and then screenwriting. There's no better background for a playwright or screenwriter than an acting career because you write good roles. It's dramatic writing. So you look back on things that seem to not be connected, and when you look back 30 years later, it's as though there was a design to the whole life.
Which Joseph Campbell would agree, saying if you look back, it looks like a perfect script.
Exactly.
Or I'm also thinking about how nature, in the natural world, nature never throws anything out. It always
Compost.
Builds on what is there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So in this case, using that tremendous background to launch you into something new.
Yeah, it was new, but it was connected. Because if you've acted, you know, in all those plays, you kind of had a heads up on how to write a good part for an actor.
Yes, I imagine the actors that acted in your screenplays were very appreciative of
viewpoint. But you know, Molière and Shakespeare were actors first before they wrote plays. So there's a lot of former actors who leave lasting marks. I'm not comparing myself to those guys by any means. It's like the minnow and the whale,
right?
Let's
talk about shamanism. I mentioned in the intro, you received a Fulbright scholarship to go to India to research shamanism.
Yes.
So talk about that. What is shamanism and how did it affect your life?
Well, what led to it was I was working on Broadway as an actor and then writing plays, and I had several plays produced in New York. I wanted to go somewhere where story and creative writing was more than a commercial enterprise. I was weighed down by the commercialism of the arts in this country. So that prompted me to apply for a Fulbright research grant. And so I called it the actor storyteller. And I wanted to study creative shamanic forms. And I studied pre-Hindu Dravidian. They were the people before the Aryans came in over 5,000 years ago. So these were 5,000-year-old art forms, dance, drama forms, and exorcism forms that still existed, though they're starting to die out. Because now, you know, it went father to son over for 5,000 years, and now the sons are becoming computer analysts or something, so we're losing it. So I wanted to get it down on film and study it.
So it's an oral tradition.
Yes, and remember, before psychiatry or psychology, there were shamans. Shamans go back 60,000 years. It's a very old form. And I think there are a lot of parallels that we can learn from today. For instance, the shaman's job, they thought that mental or physical illness was because somehow the person had separated themselves from their souls. They were split off, fragmented. And their job as shamans was to return the man or woman to his soul or his deeper self. And I think that, to me, you could say, is the job of the artist today, whichever art, is to return we live in a fragmented society. So it's not only the individuals that are sick or are fragmented, it's our society, our culture. So somehow I think the work of the artist today is a way of healing and making the person whole again.
You tell a story in your book about a synchronicity. You were at a dinner party and you had studied some Siberian shamanism.
Yeah.
Please share that story.
Well, of course, synchronicity, which Jung gave us, the concept is when two seemingly unrelated incidents happen that have symbolic meaning in the life. I had gone to a cranial therapist one day in Ojai, California, where I live, and the cranial therapist was very mediumistic. She was a bit psychic. And at the end of the session, she said, "I just finished reading this book, and I think you're supposed to read it." She put it in my hand. I went home, and it was a book about a female doctor in Russia who had gone to Siberia and met a shaman there in Altai, part of Siberia, that changed her life. I stayed up all night reading the book. I read it in one sitting. It really affected me. The next day, I had met a Hungarian trumpet player who was visiting Ojai, and he invited me for dinner at Meditation Mount, where his friend was director. We were sitting there, and right after dinner, there was a knock on the door. We opened the door. We weren't expecting anyone. There was this unusual man with a beard and a young woman who was from Berkeley, who was translating this Russian. He said, I wasn't supposed to come here, but something drew me here. And he said he was from Siberia and he was traveling doing shamanic rituals. And I said, well, that's interesting. I just finished this book and I described it to him. And he said, I am from that place.
Oh, that's amazing, amazing story of synchronicity. I'm here with Catherine Ann Jones. She's the author of The Way of Story, The Craft and Soul of Writing, and Heal Yourself with Writing. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Catherine, I would love for you to talk about how important metaphors are in our life and in unraveling our soul's purpose and how we can proceed to a greater awareness and greater presence in our lives and why images are really important. You talk about images a lot in your book for dreams and other ways. So say something about metaphor and images and why these are important.
Well, to quote an old friend of mine, Joseph Campbell, friends in New York, he said, if you want to change your life, change your metaphor. Whether consciously or unconsciously, we are living a metaphor. You know, thought has great power, and it can have positive or negative power. So whatever you meditate on or you hold in your subconscious, that's living you. The less aware you are, you're being lived by an image or a metaphor. For instance, in terms of archetypes, I'll give an example.
Please.
I think in story. So I sometimes walk with a neighbor of mine. He's an artist. And one day he was saying, I don't know why I'm always drawn to these neurotic women. I'm always drawn to these women who are needy, and I feel I can help them, but then it ends up a disaster every time. And I thought to myself, well, he's being lived by the archetype. He's caught up in Sleeping Beauty or Snow White, and he's the prince wanting to rescue the maiden. That's his archetype. That's the life metaphor. So when he finds a woman who's needy or in peril, there he is. He shows up, and that's his
it's
cue.
It's like a magnetic
Absolutely.
Attraction.
It's his cue to walk on that scenario, walk on stage. And, of course, it ends up a disaster, you know, because that's not real life, and it doesn't satisfy his real needs. But that's an example of unconsciously being lived by an archetype or metaphor.
So if that's, like you talk about birth archetypes, and if that's kind of his, what he's brought forward through since his childhood, how do we shift that then?
Well, by coming aware of it. It probably leads to the mother figure in his life, his own mother or something like that. Because, you know, we all know when something goes wrong in our childhood, those early years, for instance, you might have a father that deserted the family or the father that's indifferent to you. So your cue would be, if you find a man,